Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, we go to the Synod Hall, where it's announced that a special delegation will be dispatched to Syria to express solidarity with the people there and promote a peaceful resolution to the violence. Our correspondent, Philippa Hitchin, is up in the Synod Hall. She sends us a report and an interview with the head of the ecumenical movement, Teze. And rising prices and shortages of food around the world today, we speak to the former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations agencies based here in Rome about responses to the crisis. But first, we begin with this week's general audience.
Domine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti.
A year of catechesis dedicated to healing the rupture between what we profess and how we live our daily lives as believers in Christ and avoid do-it-yourself religions. That's what Pope Benedict XVI himself is looking for in this year of faith, which kicked off last week. The Pope spoke about his concerns on Wednesday to the thousands of pilgrims and visitors to St. Peter's Square for the general audience. Linda Bordoni reports.
To accompany Christians worldwide on the journey of the Year of Faith, which he opened last week, the Pope announced that he would be interrupting his series on the Christian School of Prayer for now to concentrate on helping people deepen their understanding of why we believe what we believe, starting with the essential formula of faith, the Creed. The Holy Father arrived at this decision following the results of the questionnaire bishops around the world were asked to answer ahead of the Synod of Bishops on the new evangelization, which is currently underway in the Vatican. The Pope highlighted some issues this revealed: a faith that is passive and private, rejection of faith formation, the rupture between faith and everyday life. He said, Christians often do not even know the core of their Catholic faith, the Creed.
May the year of faith lead all believers to a fuller knowledge of the mystery of Christ and a deeper participation in the life of his body.
So as to leave room for a certain syncretism and religious relativism, without clarity on the truths to be believed and the salvific uniqueness of Christianity. The risk is not far off today of people building a so-called do-it-yourself religion. Instead, he said, we should return to God, the God of Jesus Christ. We must rediscover the message of the gospel to bring it more deeply into our minds and our daily lives. I'm Linda Bordoni.
And now, news from the Synod on the new evangelization. Cardinal Tarcisio Bertone, the Holy See's Secretary of State, has announced a special delegation will be sent to Syria in the coming days to express solidarity with the war-torn population and seek opportunities to dialogue for a peaceful solution to the conflict. The delegation will be composed of five church leaders from five continents who are currently taking part in the Synod, and include the president of the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue, Cardinal Jean-Louis Touron, and the Archbishop of New York, Cardinal Timothy Dolan. In addition, the Holy See's Secretary for Relations with States, Archbishop Dominique Mamberti, and an official from the Secretariat of State will also be part of that delegation, which is expected to depart sometime next week once diplomatic protocols are in place. The Synod of Bishops meeting in the Vatican opened on Tuesday with a moving message from the 90-year-old Chinese bishop of Shaanxi, who spoke of the strong faith of Chinese Catholics even in times of great persecution. Bishop Lucas Lai Jingfeng himself spent 20 years in jail during China's Cultural Revolution. I would like to say that our church in China, he said, in particular the laity, has always maintained piety, faithfulness, sincerity, and devotion to the first Christians, even while undergoing 50 years of persecutions. the witness and ministry of lay people for the new evangelization on all the different continents has been one of the most significant themes at the Synod so far, as our special correspondent, Philippa Hitchin, has been finding out.
Throughout the first week of this synod, I've heard every day how important the role of lay men and women is for the re-evangelization of our post-Christian societies. The witness of lay people in politics, business, the media, the work of justice and peace, charity and development is the most effective way to combat the faith fatigue that bishops have spoken about repeatedly in their national or regional contexts. Marriage and the family, one speaker after another has stressed, is the cornerstone of new evangelization, the place where the next generation will or will not be educated in the Christian faith. Almost 100 experts, lay and religious, have been invited to the synod, although only half that number, known as auditors, are given the chance to address the assembly directly. The others are expected to share their input with the small groups that draw up the final propositions and message at the end of the three-week meeting. Half a dozen laymen from Mexico, India, Syria, Italy, Uruguay and Russia spoke at the end of the Tuesday morning session from their seats at the very back of the large synod hall. They spoke eloquently of the fear and alienation of men and women today, struggling with the effects of globalization, the financial crisis, family breakdown and an increasingly virtual and fragmented world. They stressed the need for closer Christian unity, greater solidarity with the poor, a stronger effort from churches to persuade governments to stop the fighting and promote dialogue in the Syrian conflict. There is just one couple from France, founders of the Alpha movement there, who'll be sharing some down-to-earth ideas on family life today. And some church leaders, notably a bishop from Malta this morning, have spoken sensitively about the difficulties of failed relationships, single mothers, divorcees, and others who feel let down and abandoned by the church. We have no easy answers for those people, Bishop Grech from Gozo continued, but they are looking for a clear message from this synod that God's love is for them too. From the Synod Hall, I'm Philippa Hitchin.
Well, up in the Synod Hall, Philippa had the chance to speak to Brother Alois, the prior of the ecumenical movement Taizé, based in eastern France, about responses to some of the challenges facing Europe's Christians today. Let's listen.
Brother Alois, you're here at the Synod representing the Taizé community with your own very significant ways of evangelizing, perhaps, in the contemporary world.
Yes, I'm very glad to participate in this synod, and because it's an experience of communion, of universal communion of the Church. I participated 4 years ago in the synod on the Word of God, and I found it's now much more existential, much more pastoral, much more urgent also to find ways of evangelization.
Is that because the challenges today are increasing?
I don't know if in these 4 years things have changed very much, but perhaps concerning the culture of young people, that becomes a very different culture from the generations of their elders now. And we have to make a greater effort to join this culture, to understand them.
Taizé seems to do that in a particularly effective way. What is the secret?
Surely we don't have a special secret. We just want to live the gospel in as a community and share this life with the young people. I found very significant the word of Archbishop Rowan Williams, who spoke to the synod, and he said concerning the young people are not don't want to be entertained, but want to be nourished. And I think there is something very important, yes, to welcome them, knowing that they have hunger for something, they are thirsting for something. And in Taizé, since they stay for 1 week, it's like, first of all, an empty space. They leave behind pressure from daily life, and they find a life of a moment of freedom. And then the ears open to listen to a message. I also think an experience of communion is necessary. Young people, perhaps they would not say immediately speak about communion, but they would speak about friendship, sustaining each other, sharing, simple life, listening to each other. And all these are like new words of gospel values. And this we have to allow. And then too, if they make an experience of communion like this, the heart opens because they wonder, why? Where does it come from? And there is an understanding of Christ.
You have young people coming, don't you, from literally all over the world now. What is it that attracts people before they have this experience that you're talking about of communion? What is it that first attracts people to Teze? How do they find out about you?
Well, it's very often just friends. And young people bring young people. And I think that's also one thing that we can stress more in this process of evangelization, that young people talk to young people. If they are touched by something, they would bring other young people. And of course, it's necessary that at home, when they come home from Teze to their church at home, they are welcomed by somebody, somebody who listens to them, who takes time to listen to them, which we also try to do in Teze. Each evening we remain in the church to speak personally with those who want to speak personally with somebody. I think it's a curiosity first that brings them. And perhaps it's something that we can read also in the Gospel. Many people were curious. What's happening there? Who is Jesus? And this curiosity we have to awaken.
Do you think that message can be shared by so many of these bishops who lead also very busy lives, a lot of pressure? How can they perhaps make the gospel message more interesting, more relevant to young people's lives today?
But I'm really touched here at the Synod because I see that all the bishops present here want to do that. And really they are looking for ways to do that. Of course, it's not so easy when you have to care about a big institution, yeah? And keep the institution alive and then looking for ways to be close to the people. Being close to the people. One bishop said, we bishops have to be the first evangelizers. And I feel that many want to do it and many are looking for ways to do it now.
You mentioned the intervention of the Archbishop of Canterbury, and of course, ecumenical relations is at the heart of the Teze community, isn't it? A closer witness of Christian unity.
Yes, our divisions among Christians are one of the reasons why Christianity has disappeared among young people, and we create a confusion on Christianity. And especially now for young people who don't know anything more, many young people who do not know anything about tradition and history, they don't understand these divisions. They speak about God of love and Christ, and they are divided. So it's like an enormous obstacle. And I was very glad this morning one cardinal spoke about that too.
It's one of the most important priorities, would you say, for new evangelization, is finding ways of overcoming these divisions of the past?
Yes, because we see that young people do it. For young people, this becomes irresistible to come together. We have young people from Ukraine, for example, many who come to Teze, and they come from the Orthodox Church and Catholic, Roman Catholic Church, but also Greek Catholic Church. And I just was in Kiev. And they told me, but in Teze we meet. We should meet also more often at home in our country. And they start to do it.
The need for safe spaces where they can be freed from these historical constraints.
Yes, but also remaining in communion with their church. Coming together will help the young people also to discover their own roots better and to purify our own traditions. And then we can be united much more than we think.
Brother Alois there, the prior of the ecumenical movement, Teze, speaking to Philippa Hitchin. Well, this week we're pointing the spotlight on food, not the culinary delights or cupcake kings you can see on cable TV, but the food that's becoming ever more scarce in people's tummies around the globe. The United Nations designates October 16th as World Food Day, an occasion to raise awareness about the many approaches to ending hunger. The executive director of the Alliance to End Hunger and former U.S. ambassador to the UN institutions in Rome, Tony Hall, spoke with Chris Altieri about the progress and the continuing challenges on the road to achieving a world without hunger.
It's something that I've been very concerned about, something that I've worked on for, involved with probably for the last 30 years, both as a U.S. congressman and as a U.S. ambassador.
Tell us a little bit about the history of that, your start of when you get concerned about the problem of world hunger. This is you're a congressman point, or was it even earlier than that?
Well, I was in the Peace Corps for 2 years, and I was in the country of Thailand, and I think probably that probably got me started on it because I, you know, had to live in a different country and speak a different language and live as they did. And I think it was my first experience really living among people that were very, very poor. And it really opened my eyes as to what really is going on in the world. And then I came back home and I got involved in business and I eventually ran for politics. And then I was a U.S. congressman, and I became chairman of the subcommittee on international hunger, and I was asked to go to Ethiopia one day. That was during, in 1984, when they had this horrendous famine.
Yeah, that's the height of that big famine.
And I was, I think, the first elected official, really, to take a look at it. We kept hearing about this horrendous famine, what it looked like, and I couldn't understand how so many people could be dying. I mean, it didn't make sense to me. How could this happen? And I needed to really go take a look at it. So I went over there, and I actually was with Mother Teresa's group, Sisters of Charity. I went up country about 2 hours by light plane. We landed, and we were visiting a small clinic in the middle of nowhere. And there were just a couple of nuns there, and as I was visiting, a doctor was visiting as well, and he said, "You notice the people outside. I want you to come outside with me because you're going to see something you've probably never seen before." And as we walked outside, there were thousands of people out there, and they wanted to get into this little clinic because they had heard there was going to be food and medicines and blankets and water and et cetera, because Ethiopia at the time was in the middle of a civil war. Civil war turned into a famine, and the people had been walking in this particular part of the country for, in many of the cases, well over 100 miles. The people were starving. I mean, when they arrived, their kids were not only malnourished, but they were half dead. And as I walked with them outside with the doctor, people were handing me their children, and half the children they were handing me were dead. And they thought I was a doctor. And that was the experience I had for 3 days. I was stunned. I was taken back. I was overwhelmed. I had never seen anything like this. I was absolutely startled by it. And I came back from that experience thinking that, you know, we do a lot of things in public life that really don't amount to much. And this was what I was going to devote my life to. And so from that time on, I got involved in legislation, got involved in programs, and traveled the world, got involved in my own area. I'm from Ohio, and start doing things relative to hunger and poverty and things like that.
For a country with the means that the United States has, getting a large amount of food together and into a place where it's needed is not really an extraordinarily difficult operation from the logistical point of view. But what are some of the difficulties that you faced there in maybe getting the ball rolling, I'm assuming, in addressing the Ethiopian situation right on the ground?
Well, I think one of the things you face is, one, you have to convince people that there's a problem.
And for you, it took actually going there and seeing it. So
it took me to go and see it and come home and report about it, report to the Congress, get as much publicity on it as possible to the people of the country and say, there is a problem. We have food. We can help. Mobilize the forces. Appropriate the money. and get the food that we have and send it over there. So one, create a will. Secondly, to work through some of the nonprofit organizations, Catholic Relief Services, World Vision, CARE, those kind of organizations that we trust and work with that do a pretty good job of actually delivering the food overseas, and to this day are really the best in the world. And so we've worked with them very carefully. And then be sure that we work in countries that we can work in. You know, there's a lot of countries in the world where we have, it's very, very difficult to work in. So we, if we have a government that we don't get along with too well, we go around them. We don't work directly with them. We don't give them money. We work through the nonprofits.
In the Ethiopian situation there in the 80s, you had a situation of civil war. So you had political, not just political instability, but basically political breakdown. You were in a situation of war and civil war, and a nasty one at that. At the same time, you had a lot of other factors, social factors, you know, land management that wasn't very good, farming techniques that weren't very good, that were lending themselves to a chronic problem that, because of this confluence of events, became acute. How much of your work then does actually try to address the roots of the problem, and how much are you working toward, the ready responses at this point to acute situations seem to be pretty good, right?
Right. We've come a long way since Ethiopia. We had, there was a major famine last year, still to a certain extent going on, not like it was last year, in northeast Kenya, Somalia. And, as a result of Somalia not really having a government, a very, very much of a terrorist group, shoving a lot of people out of the country, there was a famine there last year affecting as many people as it did in 1984. The way it was handled last year was so much better than it was in 1984. The same situation, the same amount of people, probably even more so, but handled so much better. And there were people that died, of course, but less people this time, 30 years later, than it was in 1984. I don't know if that's 30 years or around that figure. So we've done a much better job. Secondly, the poverty of people and the programs that we've introduced, agriculture, development, microcredit, the poverty index is really working now. I mean, in the last 10 years, the poverty index of people worldwide has absolutely come down. And that's the good news. The good news is that the work that's being done actually works, and that's wonderful. I mean, that people are actually getting better. That doesn't mean that there still are not hungry people. There's still almost a billion people that are hungry. But the poverty index of people in the world today is actually coming down, according to statistics coming from the World Bank, FAO, etc.
That's not something that you hear very often, actually, in part because people who do this job don't like good news stories as much as they like death and destruction and gloom and doom, unfortunately. But also, I imagine it has to do with the concern on the part of the people who have dedicated their lives to making sure that people do have enough to eat, that there isn't a sense of complacency that grows up.
You can never have a sense of complacency in this work. I mean, there are still 25,000 people that die every day, and they die of hunger and hunger-related diseases. But 30 years ago, when I started in this work, it was 42,000 people that were dying every day. So it really has come down. Now, 25,000 people is still a lot of people, but we are making progress.
People talk about food security issues that go beyond, the first response to acute situations.
Well, you're right. I mean, those things are being brought in. There's no question about it. I mean, for example, take Africa. Africa has made some major changes since 30 years ago. I still have to say this, though, that Africa doesn't produce any more food today than they did in 1960. And it's because, you know, they're still dealing with very archaic methods of agriculture. They still, in some of their countries, are dealing with hybrid seeds that, you know, we had in America in the 1950s. That has changed a lot in the last 3 years. There has been progress in some of these African nations that has been amazing. It's because of agriculture technology. So there's been a lot of changes. There's been a lot of collaboration between countries, between UN agencies, between the World Bank, between some of the Western nations. They're getting together and talking a much better game and putting money up. They are introducing programs like microcredit and microfinance. They're having better water systems. There's a lot of things that are happening. And they're talking about, there's this word that's being thrown around in Africa today, resilience. There's a word, and what they mean is that they are starting to get ahead of tragedies and crises that are coming in the world today. They are starting to be able to predict what's happening today and getting ahead of the curve before it becomes a crisis and putting all these things in place and be able to handle these crises before they turn into famines. And this is good. This is good news. So there are some very positive things going on. Now, the negative aspect are, one, we still got 1 billion people that are hungry. Two, we still haven't developed the political will among our leaders to really end it. And there's still a lot of things lacking. But the end game is that there has been progress.
You've laid out in broad terms here the what to do. I'm imagining that you have some ideas about best practices and about the best ways to go about achieving these goals that you've just outlined broadly. And I'm wondering whether that is, and I don't want you to give away the store, obviously, but whether that's something that you're going to be talking about in your lecture and whether you just wanted to share some of your thoughts on that here.
Well, you know, the things that I have to share are pretty common, actually, and you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out how to turn things around. School feeding is one of the best things that we can do overseas. It gets kids back in school. Clean water programs, agriculture research, better agriculture techniques, better seeds, better research, and exchange of information between countries. Microcredit, collaboration between governments. This stuff is very common stuff. It's not rocket science stuff. We just have to have the political will to put this stuff in place.
There's been some resistance, political resistance to the seeds in some areas, the use of GMO seeds, for example, and things like that. Is there anything to that?
I don't think there's anything to that. Actually, the FAO, the European Union, they have looked at this. They, 20 years ago, they really fought it. They've really come around to the issue that GMO foods are really important, and they must be part of the process in the future. They work. They really produce an abundance of food, and you can't feed people on organic food. It's too expensive. So no way.
Ambassador Hall is scheduled to deliver the George McGovern Lecture on the Changing Face of Hunger at the Rome headquarters of the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization on Thursday, October 18th. That concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. Laudator Jesus Christus.